Oh, this is Tom Scott with the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, November 12th, 2025. We begin our reading on the front page with another chapter in the Pacey story, PBL School District Burdensome Unnecessary Requirement in Proposed Order, attorney says. The district objects to a proposal to require plaintiffs be notified before information is released. Paxton. The attorney defending the Paxton-Buckley-Lota School District in lawsuits alleging the inappropriate touching of female students by teacher and former cross-country coach Rob Pacey is objecting to the plaintiff's request for a protective order requiring the district to give 3 days' notice to the plaintiffs whenever information related to their civil cases is publicly released in response to Freedom of Information Act requests. On Friday, October 31st, attorney Michael Bersani of Itzhaka-based Purvis, Condon, and Bersani PC filed the district's response to the plaintiff's October 8th motion seeking entry of the protective order with the notification requirement. In requesting the plaintiff's proposed protective order be denied and one proposed by the defendants be granted instead, Bersani called the suggested notification requirement unduly burdensome, unnecessary, and redundant, and in conflict with the statutory framework that exists going beyond the court's discretionary authority and what justice requires. Plaintiff's attorney, Bhavani Ravidran of Chicago-based Ravidran Law, LLC, has a deadline of Wednesday, November 12th to file a reply. McLean County Judge Rebecca Foley, who is presiding over the consolidated lawsuits in Ford County Circuit Court, is expected to rule on the motion for the protective order during a hearing at 9 a.m. Tuesday, November 18th via Zoom. Ravidran, who is suing the district, Pacey, and three current or former administrators on behalf of five current or former PBL students, said in her motion that the proposed notification requirement would help prevent the further release of information revealing her clients' identities to the public. On multiple occasions this year, she said, the district disclosed such private information when it should not have done so, including in February when an email identifying one of the minor plaintiffs was shared with PBL staff members and others. On July 18th, when the district released 119 pages of reports to the Edgar County watchdogs, but neglected to redact the name of a minor in at least four instances, and also failed to redact identifying information of minors' parents and at least one medical diagnosis of a minor. And on August 20th, when the district released a report on the Title IX investigation to the Ford County Chronicle that included a plaintiff's private abuse allegations and information making her identifiable within the community, including dates of discipline. Ravindran's motion also noted that she and the family of one of the plaintiffs became aware in June that a highly confidential law enforcement interview of the plaintiff, recorded last spring by the Children's Advocacy Center, was in the possession of Title IX investigators and potentially district administrators. When Title IX investigators were asked if the video had been shared, and if so, whether they could refrain from sharing it further, they confirmed that only the investigators had access to the video, but could not confirm who viewed the video, what would be done with it going forward, and whether they would agree to hold the video until protective measures were put in place. In response, Bersani noted that the defendants agree that maintaining the privacy of the individual plaintiffs is an important interest to protect, and for that reason have agreed that certain types of records, documents, and other information exchanged during discovery between the parties and subpoenaed from third parties should remain confidential, subject to a protective order pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 201C. But the plaintiff's proposed protective order goes beyond the court's discretionary authority and what justice requires, Bersani's motion said. Bersani explained. First, Illinois Supreme Court Rule 201C1 sanctions the use of protective order to regulate discovery in litigation. It is not intended to empower the litigant and, in this court, with the authority to monitor a public body's response to a request for government information submitted by the public through the Freedom of Information Act and to adjudicate the public body's compliance with the Freedom of Information Act. Second, the non-disclosure of personal and private information is already substantially protected under Freedom of Information Act, and therefore adding those exemptions to a protective order is unnecessary and redundant, and would likely embroil this court and the parties into adjudicating the district's response to every Freedom of Information Act request submitted by the public. Third, the imposition of an extra statutory notice requirement, as proposed by plaintiffs, would be unduly burdensome on the school district's obligation under the Freedom of Information Act. In outlining his arguments, Bersani first noted that Freedom of Information Act requests are completely independent of litigation, and nothing in the Illinois Supreme Court Rule 201C permits or authorizes a court to manage how a school district responds to a Freedom of Information Act request for government information submitted by a member of the general public, or permits a court to vest in a litigant's counsel the right to adjudicate what is or is not required by a Freedom of Information Act request. To approve plaintiff's draft protective order would contravene the statutory framework that exists and grant plaintiffs and their counsel rights that do not exist and that directly conflict with the Freedom of Information Act, Bersani wrote. Bersani also pointed out that the district is already obligated to follow the Freedom of Information Act, and if it does not, there are legal recourses available within the statute to enforce those obligations. There is simply no need to impose that responsibility here as part of a protective order, Bersani wrote. It is unnecessary and redundant. Bersani also noted that nothing in the Freedom of Information Act grants to a court within a civil suit's discovery process the jurisdiction or authority to adjudicate claims that the Freedom of Information Act has been violated when a unit of government responds to a Freedom of Information Act request, nor does the Freedom of Information Act permit a court to vest in a litigant's counsel a unique right to advance notice of a Freedom of Information Act request and a unique right to ask the court to adjudicate what is or is not required by the Freedom of Information Act. Requiring the district to notify the plaintiffs at least 3 court days prior to the district's responding to a Freedom of Information Act request also is not authorized or required under the Freedom of Information Act. The statute does not require that the public body provide notice to anyone, much less the subject of the requested information, Bersani wrote. If the Illinois legislature wanted to impose such a notice requirement, it would have presumably done so. The notification requirement would also be unduly burdensome on the district, Bersani wrote. The Freedom of Information Act imposes a very tight schedule to a public's request for information, Bersani wrote. A public body shall respond promptly within 5 business days after receiving the request. While there are certain statutory extensions that could be applied, in no case shall any extension exceed 5 additional days. Freedom of Information Act statute does not authorize an extension based on a public body having to provide notice to the subject of the information sought. Therefore, the legal time frame for the response is only 5 days. One can easily envision how imposing the required 3-day notice provision would frustrate and burden the district's statutory obligation to comply with the 5-day mandatory timeline. To what end is the notice being provided? Would the plaintiffs then want to review the district's Freedom of Information Act response before disclosure to the requester? Would they want to negotiate with the district whether the request could be denied outright or what documents or information should or should not be disclosed? If unsatisfied, would plaintiffs then ask this court to intervene and adjudicate the dispute over the district's Freedom of Information Act response? Plaintiff's motion fails to answer any of those questions. And if any of the questions are answered in the affirmative, the 5-day response period would have surely passed, thereby exposing the district to Freedom of Information Act litigation and liability by the requester. Plaintiff's proposed order puts the district in a lose-lose situation. Faced with a Freedom of Information Act request for records related to plaintiffs or the allegations of their suits, the district must timely respond to the Freedom of Information Act request. Under the proposed protective order, the district would be required to give plaintiff's counsel at least 3 court days' notice of the Freedom of Information Act request before responding. The district would be left with no more than 2 days to timely comply with the Freedom of Information Act request. If, within those 2 days, plaintiff's counsel demands a specific outcome regarding the record sought within the Freedom of Information Act request that is inconsistent with the district's good faith interpretation of the Freedom of Information Act, or files a motion before this court to stop the district's compliance with its statutory responsibility to timely respond to the Freedom of Information Act request, the district must choose to either timely comply with the Freedom of Information Act request as it deems appropriate and risk being held in contempt, or violate the Freedom of Information Act by providing a tardy response to the Freedom of Information Act request and be exposed to a suit and liability for violating the Freedom of Information Act. Bersani also addressed the various instances cited by Ravindran regarding the release of private information on the plaintiffs. Regarding the February email shared between staff, Bersani said, "Plaintiffs did not attach the referenced emails to their motion, making it impossible for this court and defendants to assess the relevancy. In any event, an internal email exchange has nothing to do with the Freedom of Information Act, and therefore is immaterial to whether this court should impose the requested provisions to the protective order. In regards to concerns that the Children's Advocacy Center interview may have been shared with others besides the Title IX investigators, Bersani noted, "Plaintiff's counsel speculates that others, including school administrators, obtained and viewed the video, but they offer no proof to support that accusation. And in any event, like the above-mentioned email exchange, this issue has nothing to do with the district's response to a Freedom of Information Act request." Requesting the release of private information to the Edgar County watchdogs, Bersani noted, "The records were heavily redacted by the school district, but there was some personal identifying information inadvertently disclosed. That issue was quickly corrected and has not recurred." Regarding the Title IX investigation reports released to the Ford County Chronicle, Bersani noted, "For context, these reports were generated as a result of a complaint filed with the district by one of the plaintiffs. The court can take judicial notice of the news reports of the public attending Board of Education meetings this past spring and summer, clamoring for more information about the nature, status, and disposition of those investigations. The public used the Freedom of Information Act as well to gain information. The district's responsibility under the Freedom of Information Act was to provide that information while at the same time protecting private and personal information, including names. Plaintiffs concede that, in that instance, all names were properly redacted pursuant to the Freedom of Information Act exemptions, and therefore they do not argue that the Freedom of Information Act was violated. Rather, they vaguely and speculatively argue that one plaintiff's identity could possibly be determined by the community through the unredacted allegations and information in the reports. Plaintiffs do not explain how the district is supposed to discern what the public may or may not determine in their individual or collective minds, nor do they explain how it was that any different than what the plaintiffs alleged themselves in the three lawsuits publicly filed in these consolidated cases and widely reported in the press. The district complied with the Freedom of Information Act exemptions by redacting names. Any further withholding of information would run the risk of the requester then complaining that the district is not being transparent with the operation of its government and would likely subject the district to Freedom of Information Act litigation and liability. In summary, the Freedom of Information Act statute presumes all government information is subject to public disclosure with limited exceptions, such as redacting names. This is the balance struck by the Illinois legislature, and it was indisputably followed in the district's August Freedom of Information Act response. The lawsuits filed by Ravindran, which have been consolidated into one case, allege that Pacey inappropriately touched numerous female students over the course of his 17 years of employment at PBL, and that administrators did not properly address students' claim of misconduct, ignoring the district's own policy by never notifying the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services as required. Pacey, who was suspended with pay last spring from his job as a STEM teacher and technology teacher at Clara Peterson Elementary School, has not been criminally charged and has denied any wrongdoing. Turning to the inside of the paper, we have from the Ford County Zoning Board of Appeals, Opposition Surfacing for Solar Projects, by Diane Perkins for the Ford County Chronicle in Gibson City. A petition has surfaced asking that the Ford County Zoning Board of Appeals deny special use permits for two proposed 5-megawatt commercial solar farms just north of Gibson City. Nearly 150 people had signed the petition as of Wednesday, November 5th, in advance of the Zoning Board of Appeals public hearing on the projects set for 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 9th at the courthouse in Paxton. The petition states that the people signing it support the advancement of renewable energy, but believe this project poses unacceptable risks and consequences for nearby residents, local farms, and the environment. It also states the location and scale are entirely incompatible with the surrounding community. The two co-located projects, known as Goldenrod East LLC and Goldenrod West LLC, would be built on 62.6 and 64.5 acres, respectively, of agriculturally zoned land owned by Doug Brooker on the East Road in Drummer Township, formerly part of the Railside Golf Course. JAS Power LLC, a subsidiary of Greenvolt LLC, is the developer of the projects, which would involve with 9,016 solar modules. Several specific concerns are listed in the newly launched online petition, including the project's impact on the community's character and appearance, a reduction in the value of neighboring properties, and drainage, flooding, and agricultural concerns. petition mentions the alteration of the rural and residential character of the area by replacing the open farmland and scenic landscapes of Drummer Township with rows of industrial solar panels, fencing, and equipment. The project's proximity to nearby homes could diminish property enjoyment and erode the visual quality that makes this community desirable, the petition says. There is also a concern that the project could affect future expansion of the city to the north. If a new subdivision were to be built in the area, the solar farm could detract from new home sales, the petition noted. Plus, the project would put a hard boundary on any additional growth. The petition also states that the proposed project site currently supports natural drainage for nearby farmland and residential properties, but that flow would be disrupted by construction activities such as grading and panel installation. Projects could also increase surface runoff and create the potential for erosion and flooding in surrounding areas, according to the petition. The petition recommends the Zoning Board of Appeal reject the projects and prevent similar inappropriate siting in the future. It suggests renewable energy development be pursued responsibly without placing industrial projects in close proximity to homes and productive farmland. Testimony will be taken during the December 9th hearing, which was recessed from October 27th to allow the developer more time to submit an extensive list of required information that it did not yet provide. After testimony is taken, the Zoning Board of Appeals is expected to issue a recommendation on whether the conditional use permit applications should be approved by the County Board. To view a copy of the petition, or to sign it, there is a website here. I will read it, but people can visit https://c.org/6by6cpz85l, or probably just Gibson City petition. The article was written by Diane Perkins, a Sibley resident, is an occasional contributor to the Ford County Chronicle. She could be reached via email at eiu8019@gmail.com. Now we'll turn to the obituaries in the Ford County Chronicle for Wednesday, November 12th. Bonnie Buffs, and that is spelled B-U-H-S, Gibson City. Bonnie Buffs, 68, of Gibson City, died Sunday, November 2nd, surrounded by family. Funeral services were held Friday, November 7th, at the Rosenbaum Funeral Home in Gibson City. Burial followed at Drummer Township Cemetery in Gibson City. Linda Sue Gebauer, and that's spelled G-E-B-A-U-E-R, Rantoul. Linda Sue Gebauer, 66, of Rantoul, died Sunday, November 2nd. A celebration of life will be at a later date. Turning back to the front page, we have an article entitled, Remembering When Ford, County that is, Preferred Chevy. A look back, commercial filmed in Ford County in late 1989. Citizen actors remember when TV ads brought the county to national forefront. Dana Sauer didn't have to worry about fumbling his lines in the run-up to his and a variety of other Ford County citizen actors' 15 minutes of fame. I didn't have any speaking part, the Paxton area farmer said of his role in one of six Chevy truck commercials created in Ford County. Filmed in late 1989, commercials were a big deal in the small ag-based county. Residents showed up to try out for parts for television ads that were shown nationally, and many residents remember the commercials with fondness. I just sat there with a newspaper, the Ford County Press, And Everett Gibbs, who had all the lines, Sauer said, of the commercial he appeared in. Sauer and Gibbs' commercial was shot in Piper City, and it wasn't a quick and easy thing, Sauer saying it took most of the day. The amateur actors came to realize that speaking lines with a camera rolling isn't as easy as it looks. Everett Gibbs couldn't quite get the message out correctly, Sauer said. About 3 p.m, the director said, "We'll just stop." And Gibbs' lines were edited to get the desired effect. The commercials had a homespun appeal. Chevrolet wanted to poke the bear, so to speak, its main competition being Ford trucks, by touting that it sold more trucks in Ford County, Illinois, than its namesake did during a certain period. The commercials were a playful take, with many of the participants being gray-haired citizens using such terms as electrolytic deposition of zinc on steel, and a woman's sewing group discussing the truck's Bauhaus influence. One commercial included former Gibson City clerk Jan Hall and her grandmother. "They wanted it to be funny," Hall said. "My grandmother had snow-white hair with little glasses. She responded to somebody's comment about the new Chevy truck. 'Oh my, yes, it has such quiet hydraulic valve lifters.'" In one Melbourne-based ad, barber John Clark, while trimming the hair of a customer, quipped he always thought Ford County was on the cutting edge. Some actors were recruited for their roles by chance. Others were chosen by chance. Ford County, named after Illinois' 8th governor, Thomas Ford, was selected for the ads, which had a theme of "People from Ford prefer Chevy trucks," due to some fragmented figures, although Ford Motor Company officials took exception to their rivals playing with the numbers. The statistics were true for a partial segment of 1988-89, when Chevy outsold Ford by one truck from 77 to 76. Chevy came out second for the entire calendar year of 1988, however. The commercials received widespread attention nationally. They were the subject of feature stories or columns that appeared in several major newspapers and trade journals, including Ad Age, The Wall Street Journal, and the Chicago Tribune. At an auto show in Detroit, a Ford Motor Company official announced the company was challenging the accuracy of the sales figures claimed by Chevrolet. The announcement didn't bother Chevy officials. To the contrary, it drew attention to their commercials. Ford even sent its dealers letters refuting Chevrolet's claims. Ford also aired a rebuttal ad, informing viewers that not only does Ford sell more trucks in Ford County, Illinois, but the same is also true in Ford County, Kansas, Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania, and even Chevy Chase, Maryland. In total, 19 Ford County residents appeared in the Chevy truck commercials, which first aired December 23rd. The company ran ads in Ford County newspapers listing on what shows they would appear, ranging from NFL football to Murphy Brown. The 30-second ads can be viewed on YouTube, meaning the county's 15 minutes of fame lasted longer than most. And that's all the time we have for this week's reading of the Ford County Chronicle. This is Tom Scott. I look forward to reading with you again very soon.